Today is Wednesday, March 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Mozambique braced itself Tuesday for a mounting death toll and a host of humanitarian needs in the wake of Cyclone Idai.
That's VOA correspondent Anita Powell reporting on the devastation left by a cyclone that ripped through southern Africa. Also, New Zealand police continue to work to identify those slain in last Friday's attack at two mosques. And Italy's government seizes a rescue ship and may charge its crew with illegal migration. It's all on today's International Edition. New Zealand police continue to work with families to positively identify those slain in last Friday's attack at two Christchurch mosques, while members of the community buried their dead today. Two Syrian refugees, a father and a son, were laid to rest in the city's memorial park. The funeral was attended by hundreds, some who flew in from out of town. New Zealand Police Commissioner Mike Bush said that identifying the remaining bodies and getting them to their families so that burials can be performed remains an utmost priority. I spoke with VOA's Steve Miller about the busy day in Christchurch today.
This is something that residents of New Zealand, and even specifically here in Christchurch, people really thought was never going to happen. I spoke to an imam the other day who was visiting from Auckland, and he described it this way. So when you look at radicalism, notions of white supremacy, or any kind of, you know, really fringe elements in the world, they tend to take place in the United States, in Europe, far away from New Zealand. And, you know, people have joked about New Zealand is this country at the corner of the world that's sometimes left off the map. So if these ideas ever do come to New Zealand, they're usually very watered down or diminished. So to have this kind of attack here in New Zealand was very disruptive. But the one thing that's been very, you know, cognizant and very much in the forefront of everybody's notion is how quickly the community has come together. Residents here continue to stop by daily the Hagley Park, which is across the street from the Al Noor Mosque, to lay flowers, to write letters and words of support. Yesterday, Krista Casey, who was with the Ministry of Education, was here in Christchurch, and she let reporters know and the community know that crisis management teams, the trauma response teams within the Ministry of Education, were not only here in Christchurch and the Southern Island, but also in the Northern Island to some 20 schools that had some direct ties to the killings, whether they knew someone who was here, whether they were part of the Muslim population, or whether they were just greatly affected. So the whole country as a whole is actually coming together pretty tight-knitly to make sure that whatever needs to be done is being done to support the needs of the Muslim community here in Christchurch, but also the greater community of the country as a whole.
Now, for many young children there, they have not experienced this type of violence. How are they coping?
Well, a lot of younger children still really don't know what happened. I spoke to one mother today, and you know, she looked at me because I asked her the question, you know, how do you explain these kinds of horrific events to children? Because as adults, many are grappling with the notion. She looked at me and she said, I can't find the words. There are no words for this. What happened deeply affected us. We know people who were killed. This affected the entire community. There's a lot of anger there, and there's grief. And it's just going to take time for us to move forward. And you have to also remember that this is a community that was greatly affected by the 2011 earthquake that killed 185 people here. There still are installations here in the Central Business District, remembering those lives that were lost in 2011. 8 years ago. That installation is now being augmented with the remembrances of 50 more people who have been killed in a horrific event.
How is the process of the burials? How is that taking place?
Well, the first few burials did take place today, Mike Bush, who is the New Zealand Police Commissioner, informed the public earlier today that as of 11:30 p.m. last evening, 21 of the bodies had been identified and were being prepared to be released to the family members. He acknowledged that the process is going slower than they anticipated because they had hoped to actually have all the bodies positively identified and released to family members no later than Wednesday, but said that would take just a little bit longer. But it was still very much a priority for the police department because he recognized the cultural and religious significance of doing this as quickly as possible to allow the healing process to begin.
That was VOA's Steve Miller in Christchurch, New Zealand. The Italian government has seized the rescue ship, the Mare Ionio, and is considering charging its crew with aiding illegal migration. The ship, operated by the Italian aid group Mediterranea, had rescued 50 migrants from 70 kilometers off the coast of Libya. The Italian government at first refused to let the ship dock in Italy, but yesterday allowed it to enter the port of Lampedusa. Journalist Josephine McKenna in Rome has been following this story. She spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson earlier today.
Well, the Italian authorities have effectively seized this NGO ship, the Mare Ionio, after 49 migrants were allowed to disembark in Lampedusa, the island just off the south coast of Sicily. Now, the migrants include 35 men and 15 children, 15 minors. They come from several different African countries, including Cameroon, Guinea, Nigeria, and Senegal. And some of them were heard shouting, "Liberté," freedom, after the ship docked on Tuesday evening. So these migrants were rescued when their rubber dinghy sank or began to sink about 40 miles off the coast of Libya. The NGO Mediterranea intervened, rescued those migrants, and took them to Italy.
So they have been offloaded. They're in Lampedusa. What is next for the migrants at this point?
Well, they haven't been given a very warm welcome. In fact, Italy's hardline Deputy Premier and Interior Minister Matteo Salvini has suggested that those who intervened have done the wrong thing. He's called them anarchists and warned that they will pay the price. Now, Sicilian prosecutors have begun interrogating members of the crew. They face potential charges for promoting illegal immigration. So that is a very dramatic hard line from this government. And the head of the mission run by Mediterranea, Luca Casarini, said this ship had violated no law and simply abided by international conventions that required the migrants be brought to a secure port.
Why did they not take them to another port? Spain has been a little bit more welcoming. There have been a few other places.
Well, in fact, the Italian government is arguing these migrants should have been taken to Tunisia or another country that was far closer than Lampedusa. But this group, called Mediterranea, felt that Italy was a safe port of call. There have been reports that some of these migrants have been previously sent back to Libya up to five times, and many of them are reported incidences of torture and indeed of even seeing people die in these dangerous crossings on the Mediterranean. But the intention of this mission was to bring the migrants to a safe port of call, and that is one of the reasons, I think, why they chose Lampedusa.
Now, can you sum up the government's position? This is a government that was elected last year, and part of their position has been on, their campaign had been on migration. Can you sum up their position in this case and others like it?
Well, this is a coalition government of two populist parties, and it's dominated by the very hardline right-wing League Party that is led by Matteo Salvini, the current Deputy Prime Minister and Interior Minister. Now, he built his election campaign on an anti-immigration stance. He's held a very hard line since this coalition was formed in June last year. And he says that anybody seeking to rescue migrants will be finding Italian ports closed unless there's any kind of mission that's authorized. He's constantly posting xenophobic tweets and Facebook messages that are anti-immigration. But this government argues that it has taken a very strong stance and it is seeing the results. So far this year, we've only seen 398 migrants cross the Mediterranean. In the same period last year, more than 6,000 migrants crossed the Mediterranean to Italy from the north coast of Africa in the first 3 months of 2018.
That was Josephine McKenna in Rome speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Among the top stories in the world, U.S.-backed forces searched through the remnants of the Islamic State's final enclave in northeastern Syria, looking for fighters, mines, and booby-trapped explosives. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in the Middle East for security talks as Washington looks to draw new support in its opposition to Iranian aggression. And British Prime Minister Theresa May asked the EU today to delay Britain's exit from the 28-nation bloc for 3 months until June 30th. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A large group of scientists say they have traced the origin of tiny meteorites that fell on a Turkish village in September 2015. The researchers suggest that a collision that created the Antonia impact crater on the asteroid 4 Vesta some 22 million years ago is what produced the pea-sized meteorites. Scientists found that the meteorites are of a type called howardite, which are said to originate from the surface of 4 Vesta, the second largest asteroid in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Isotopic studies were used to determine that the meteorites in Turkey were of the howardite type. Researchers determined that the tiny meteorites were produced when a meteoroid about 1 meter in size fragmented at an altitude of about 27 kilometers as it entered Earth's atmosphere at a speed of 17 kilometers per second. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. Special Envoy for Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, says Russia and the U.S. have failed to come to an agreement on how to resolve the crisis in Venezuela following talks in Rome. He did not rule out a future meeting between both sides and said the talks helped both sides gain a better understanding of each other's views. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
The United States Special Envoy for Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, described the Rome talks with Russian officials on the crisis in Venezuela as useful, substantial, and serious. He said the conversations allowed the United States to understand that, in his words, Russia sees the crisis in Venezuela as very serious, unlike President Maduro. Mainly, Abrams said, in regards to the economic and humanitarian aspects. Following a meeting with Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, Abrams said, "We did not come to a meeting of the minds, but the talks were positive in the sense that I think both sides emerged with a better understanding of the other's views. The two sides remain at odds over the legitimacy of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The United States has recognized self-declared President Juan Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate leader, while Russia continues to recognize Mr. Maduro. Italy also has not given Mr. Guaido recognition." Abrams met with Pietro Benassi, the diplomatic advisor of Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Abrams said the United States is not applying pressure on the Italian government to recognize Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate president. The meetings in the Italian capital took place as the United States imposed fresh sanctions on Venezuela, this time targeting the state-run gold mining company Minerven and its president. But at the White House, President Donald Trump on Tuesday reiterated that all options are open on the future of Venezuela.
"We're not looking for anything other than taking care of a lot of people that are starving and dying in the streets. What's happening there is a disgrace."
Abrams stressed that negotiations are not underway because we do not negotiate the future of Venezuela with Russia or others, because the future of Venezuela's will be chosen by the Venezuelans. Moscow strongly warned the United States against any temptation to resort to military power in Venezuela. Russian state news agency TASS quoted Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov as saying, We assume that Washington treats our priorities seriously, our approach, and warnings. Abrams did not exclude a future meeting with Russia on the Venezuelan crisis, but said no date had been set. The White House said President Trump will also discuss the Venezuelan crisis with Caribbean leaders on Friday. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Thank you, Sabina. Well, the leaders of the Western Hemisphere's two largest economies are pledging closer trade ties as well as enhanced military cooperation with U.S. President Donald Trump, even suggesting Brazil should be able to join NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance. Trump, at a news conference Tuesday in the White House Rose Garden, also pledged American support for Brazil to join the 36-member Organization for Cooperation and Economic Development, which includes most of the highly developed economies. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has more.
Jair Bolsonaro, known as the Trump of the tropics, said he comes to Washington as the first Brazilian president in decades who is not anti-American and wants to work with the United States to ensure the removal of Nicolas Maduro from power in Caracas. Trump reiterated, all options are open, when asked by a reporter if military intervention in Venezuela by the United States is possible. Bolsonaro did not make any references to an invasion of his country's neighbor, but he did say we need to put an end to the suffering of Venezuela's people. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Vice President of Malawi, Saulos Chilema. The Malayan politician and VOA's Shaka Sali discuss democracy and the upcoming elections. An in-depth look at Malawi's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
The coastal nation of Mozambique appears to have been the hardest hit by Cyclone Idai, which ravaged southern Africa a few days ago. The nation's president estimates that as many as 1,000 people have died, many of them in the port city of Beira. Neighboring South Africa has sent soldiers to help with search and rescue efforts and is appealing to local companies to donate goods and services. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Mozambique braced itself Tuesday for a mounting death toll and a host of humanitarian needs in the wake of Cyclone Idai, which hit the coastal city of Beira on Friday before moving through Mozambique and on to Malawi and Zimbabwe. The initial official death toll stood at 84, but Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi announced late Monday, after flying over the affected areas, that he estimated the number could be as high as 1,000. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said in a statement Monday that the damage to Beira was massive and horrifying, and estimated that 90% of the city, which is home to more than 500,000 people, was destroyed. On Tuesday, Mozambique-based UNICEF spokesman Daniel Tima said the agency is still seeking information on the impact of the storm. He spoke to VOA via Skype from Maputo, the capital.
At the moment, still don't have the full picture of the situation. But we agree with the assessment of the government that the disaster is of a dimension which is much, much bigger than we thought in the beginning. This is due to the fact that information was coming in very slowly because the city of Beira had been cut off all communication lines and still is. And it's also cut off physically because the roads to Beira are destroyed.
Nivuwa Mabaya, spokesman for the South African Department of International Relations and Cooperation, told VOA that members of the South African National Defense Force landed in Mozambique on Saturday to assist that nation's military in search and rescue efforts. South Africa will try to do more, he said.
We have also called on South African companies to donate for humanitarian assistance. Following this morning's assessment, we'll make a further announcement of how we will assist going forward.
Timmis said once the rescue is done, humanitarian agencies will still have serious work to do. To that end, UNICEF has appealed to donors for $20.3 million to support its response in all three affected countries. On Tuesday, the European Union announced it would release an initial emergency aid package of 3.5 million euro, nearly $4 million, to assist all three countries. Mozambique will receive much of that money. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, a senior U.S. official accuses Russia of breaching several arms control treaties considered critical for maintaining world peace. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Assistant Secretary Yelena Poblate made a blistering attack against what she called Russia's aggressive, destabilizing activities. She cites Moscow's invasion of neighboring countries, the annexation of Crimea, and its failure to comply with arms control treaties as actions that threaten global stability. She says there are many concerns regarding Russia's observance of the Biological Weapons Convention. She says Russia's use of a military-grade nerve agent in an assassination attempt in Britain, as well as its tolerance of the use of chemical weapons in Syria, are a clear violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. She says Russia's development and fielding of a ground-launched cruise missile is in clear violation of the INF, or Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty.
The Russian Federation's violation of the INF Treaty poses a direct threat to European, U.S., East Asian, and global security. It is a destabilizing and has a corrosive effect on arms control and disarmament.
The United States warns it will withdraw from the INF Treaty in August if Moscow does not live up to the terms of the accord. Poblate refers to Russia as a malign actor. She says Russia is not a responsible actor that intends to uphold its obligations under arms control and disarmament agreements. The Russian representative at the meeting did not react to the accusations. He said his country's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, would respond to what he called America's unfounded claims at a speech to the Conference on Disarmament Wednesday. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, in health news, a new test can quickly identify a common and dangerous condition during pregnancy and help mothers and babies healthy and safe. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
Want to go down the slide?
When Jessie Przinski was pregnant with her first child, her feet started swelling.
Well, you hear everybody tells you, you know, the swollen ankles and, you know, get your feet up and all that. And so that was kind of where I just thought, okay. And then it started to be, kind of looks like it's in my arms and my hands too.
Most women expect some swelling when they're pregnant, but these symptoms can be signs of preeclampsia. That's a complication of pregnancy that raises the mother's blood pressure and affects the blood flow to the placenta. This can lead to smaller or premature babies. Untreated, it can be fatal to the mom or baby or both. Researchers at the Ohio State Wexner Medical Center have developed a fast and easy test to diagnose preeclampsia. That's where Dr. Kara Rood practices maternal and fetal medicine.
One of the hard parts with preeclampsia is there's a lot of symptoms of just pregnancy alone and other medical conditions that have similar symptoms that the women experience, like high blood pressure, headaches, changes in vision. Those can be contributed to a lot of other things.
Preeclampsia is more serious if it occurs earlier in the pregnancy or in a woman who had high blood pressure before getting pregnant. Dr. Rood says managing this condition early on is best for both mothers and babies.
Without the certainty of this test aiding in the diagnosis, we as providers are definitely overcautious, as this is definitely something we don't want to miss because of the life-threatening results of a misdiagnosis for moms and babies.
Because of her preeclampsia, Przinski was induced 3 weeks early. She had a successful second pregnancy and has this advice for other women.
The biggest thing is listening to your body.
The test is so easy, women can take it at home. That way, preeclampsia can be treated as soon as it develops. The researchers expect the test to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration in the next few years. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
And you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.